I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer, and we're going to start this hour with an idea that how you remember your past is very much informed about how you're experiencing the present. Now, that's not only Therapy 101, but it's also the emerging consensus among brain scientists. And Charles Fernyhough looks into this in his new book about how memory works in our brains, and he takes us on a journey of watching his own perceptions of his past shift in real time. The book is called Pieces of Light, How the New Science of Memory Illuminates the Stories We Tell About Our Past. Charles, welcome to WNYC.
Hi, Anna.
I love this sentence that you open your book with, remembering happens in the present tense, that every time you're accessing a memory, you're creating something new. How does that work?
Well, people tend to think that memory works like this device that records, like a video camera. What we know from the science is that this is a mistaken conception. Actually, what happens is we don't film stuff and you know, pull it back for later viewing, like we'd pull down a DVD from the shelf. We gather together information and we store it in different parts of the brain. And when it comes time to remember an event, we pull together all those different bits of information into a new reconstruction. And so sometimes bits of information that shouldn't be in that memory end up getting incorporated, and that's how, you know, we can end up with false memories, distorted memories, and so on.
And you write about part of the way scientists discovered this, part of the process of reconsolidation is the word that you use. Scientists at NYU were looking at rats and trying to block memory formation, and they found they also were blocking memory recall. Tell me about that.
Well, it turns out that if you use a drug or something which affects the process of laying down a memory, that drug is also effective at the moment when that memory is recalled. So it's like every time you recall a memory, you're opening it up again, and it can be changed at that moment of recall. So scientists got very excited about this sort of process that's going on at a very, you know, microscopic level in terms of actual neural processes. But on a bigger scale, what we're doing with memory all the time is creating these reconstructions, these sort of collages of information which aren't actual literal depictions, literal representations of what happened. They're kind of creations that we make in the moment according to the needs of the present. You know, we make memories according to who we are now, what we want now, what our biases are now, and so on.
I found that when I was reading your book, that I was following along the science, and I was like, oh, that's interesting. This is how they found out this. This is how they found out that. And then I'd have to pause and say, wait, this is blowing my mind. My memories are not something that I can just pull up. There's something that is always shifting.
That's right. And if you ask people about memory, you know, lots of people think that it works like a video camera. Lots of people recognize that there are these problems with our memories, that they let us down, that we can have false memories. But the interesting thing is, how does memory go wrong and why does it go wrong? And it turns out that by studying the errors that people make, the mistakes they make with memory, you can learn a huge amount about how this process of reconstruction actually works in the brain. So studying the errors, studying what goes wrong, you can see how this complicated machine actually works.
Okay, let's talk about that, because you break out two different kinds of memory, that there's the kind of memory in your brain where you're remembering facts, and then there's the kind of memories where you're remembering what's happened to you. So is part of the way that all of this is sort of fluid, that the way we think about the facts of what has happened to us depends on where we are and how we're thinking about the narrative of our lives?
I think that's a good point. The one thing about memory is that it's a huge topic, you know, and we try to break it down into these different areas. We talk about memories for facts, we talk about memories for actions, and they seem to be underpinned by different neural processes, different cognitive systems. So the kind of memory I'm interested in is the memories you have for the events of your own life. We call this autobiographical memory, the stories you tell about your own past. But even that sort of memory, it's not as simple as being just about memory for events, because when I ask you to recall something from your past, I mean, if I say to you, think of your first day at school or the first time you hosted a radio show, you'll have certain impressions that will come to mind. You'll have those, what we call episodic memories of the event, but you'll also bring in information about who you were at that time. You know, you'll be thinking, oh, yeah, I hosted my first radio show in 2000, whatever. You know, you'll bring in, and at that point I was living in a certain part of the city or whatever. You know, you'll bring in factual information about your past, and you'll combine that with your episodic memories, the memories for the actual events. And you might pull in some other stuff as well. You might pull in some stuff that shouldn't be there at all. You might pull in some information that really doesn't belong in that memory.
So listeners, I want to hear what you have to say about this and how this makes you think about memory. And if there was a moment when you were startled to discover that your recollection of something was completely off, we want to hear those stories of messed up memories. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. So you also talk about social factors being part of the process of memory formation. And it made me sort of wonder, I come from a big family, and I feel like the way that I think about my childhood is very much informed by what my sisters have, the anecdotes they've brought up over the years, and then that becomes this mesh of what I remember, as opposed to if I were an only child, I'd have less of a record. So is that part of the social factors that you're talking about?
Absolutely. And, you know, we know that memory in childhood is quite fragile. As I say, memory is a system with many moving parts. It takes a while for it to get going, and that's one reason why we don't remember far back into our childhoods. You know, we typically have our earliest memories from age 3 or 4 or something. And when children are starting to think about the past, of course, they get influenced by what other people are saying about the past. And it turns out that the way that parents talk about the past is very influential on how those kids then go on to tell their own stories about what happened. So we get social influences coming in from early on, the things that parents say, the ways in which parents talk to their children about the past, but also the stories that kids hear. And it's been observed many, many times that those early memories often turn out to be contaminated by what somebody else has said. Or, for example, you may well have had the experience of thinking you had a memory of an event, and then suddenly you come across the photograph that depicted that event, and you think, oh, hang on a minute, maybe I'm just remembering that photograph, which I may not have seen for 20 years, but that's the source of my memory. So all these factors come to bear. But it happens throughout our lives. You know, we're constantly shaping, reshaping each other's memories. So when we form partnerships with people, as couples, we're constantly sort of negotiating a narrative of the past, which we kind of come to an agreement on and share. Those pressures don't apply in the same way to siblings, who are constantly, in my experience, talking to people for this book, constantly arguing about what happened in
yes.
the past. They're constantly arguing about, you know, dad said this, oh no, dad said that. And because they're not in the same kind of, they don't have the same sort of pressures on them to agree, to negotiate a joint account of the past that couples do, siblings often have these amazing, long-running disagreements about what happened.
And you mentioned, so brain scientists have studied the errors in our recollection, and that's what's led to a lot of the understanding of how the brain has actually worked. Tell me the story of one of those errors and what it taught scientists.
Well, there are several things that can go wrong with memory. For example, we're often biased. Biases come into our memories where who we are now shapes the kind of things we remember. It's quite hard often to, you know, as you get older, your political views often change, and it's sometimes quite hard to recall how you felt about, you know, a political movement, about a political figure, for example, because who you are now kind of overwrites or changes the way you frame those memories. So there are many things that go on like that. Yeah.
Like, and it's difficult to access memory of anxiety about a choice when you chose one particular way and it ended up being fine, but it's difficult to access the memory of that emotion in that moment.
Yeah, I think so, because we're the people we are now, and when we create these collages that are our memories, these reconstructions of our own past, they're shaped by the story we want to tell about ourselves now, as much as by what actually happened.
Do you have a better memory if you have very stark, sort of separate experiences growing up, if you lived in one place at this time and then one place another time, and there's less sort of bleeding between these experiences? Does that capture moments in a better way?
I think that's a good question. One thing that we know about memory is it's very context dependent. So when something happens to us, we're taking in information about the surroundings, about the place that we're in. And even though we may not be paying attention to the surroundings, we're taking that information in. So if you then put us back in that context, it becomes much easier to recall those memories. Now, I suppose you could then argue that if you lived in the same place for a long time, then those memories would be very tied to that place, and it wouldn't be until you actually go back to that place that you that all the memories come back. But, you know, I think this is an interesting question. I'm not aware that this has been studied, actually, but it'd be well worth looking at.
So there's this consensus in brain science that memories are something that we are constructing in real time, and as a result are not fixed. They can change. Are political and social institutions that rely on memory, for example, judicial testimony, beginning to take all this into account?
It is starting to change. So in the UK, for example, the British Psychological Society actually commissioned a report, and they said to some psychologists, can you write a report on what we know about memory so that we can give this to the lawyers, to the judges, to the police officers, and so on? And so, you know, the fallibility of memory is starting to be factored into legal judgments. And similar things are happening in the States. Some big changes to the way that in New Jersey, the way that eyewitness testimony is being incorporated and admitted in court. And I think it will, it's starting to happen in other states as well. And I think we'll see less of an emphasis on eyewitness testimony as this message about memory really takes hold.
Hmm. Debbie in Long Island, you have a question about how memory works for older people.
I wanted to know, I have elderly parents who have wonderful recall for the past, and they have details and stories, but when it comes to things that happened a few days ago or a week ago, they don't have much recall at all, and I was wondering how that works.
Well, I spent a lot of time in my book interviewing my own grandmother, who was 93 years old, and she showed exactly that same pattern. We see it's a very, very common pattern. And in fact, if you ask anybody over the age of about 40, what do you remember? Tell me everything you remember, and you ask them to write down all their memories, you'll find that they cluster around a particular period in time. You'll find that they cluster around the late teens and early adulthood. It's called the reminiscence bump. You know, everybody shows it. And it applies whether you're 40 or 90. So when I talked to my grandmother at great length about her past, her memories of the Second World War, living in London during the Blitz, she remembered all that stuff really, really well. Ask her what had happened in the 70s or the 80s or the 90s, and there wasn't a huge amount there. So it's a very common finding. What we also know is that certain kinds of memories that are known as flashbulb memories, where a very highly emotional event seems to kind of burn in a memory of where you were when you heard the news, who you were with, what the context was, and so on. Those older people are susceptible to those sorts of memories as well. So there was a study done recently in Denmark of elderly people who recalled the invasion of Denmark and then the liberation of Denmark in 1940, 1945, respectively. And these people had very accurate flashbulb memories of these momentous events happening. But they'd have been, not particularly good at recalling events from the decade or two prior to that. So it's a very common finding that people seem, older people seem to be in touch with the earlier years of their lives, and there's less, maybe it's because less new stuff happens, in the latter part of your life, and so things aren't so memorable. There are various reasons why we might show this reminiscent bump, but it's a very, very well replicated finding.
I see.
I'm Anna Sale in for Brian Lehr, and I'm speaking to Charles Fernyhough, the author of Pieces of Light, How the New Science of Memory Illuminates the Stories We Tell About Our Past. And you mentioned your grandmother's recollections about the Blitz in London. Stephanie in Fairfield, Connecticut, has a question about how traumatic memories work.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm a psychotherapist, and we psychotherapists work with memories, especially early childhood memories, and especially around trauma. And it seems to me that those kinds of memories, people seem to retain a lot of the detail. It's not tainted by other people's perspectives. They're very clear about what they remember. And lots of times when people, adults, don't have access to certain childhood memories, it's because the trauma has been so severe that they've repressed that memory altogether. So I'm wondering if you're differentiating between different types of memory and those that are connected with very intense experiences and very intense emotions.
Does traumatic memory work differently in the brain, Charles?
This is a very important question, and I talk about it at some length in the book. I interviewed somebody who was in a fatal road traffic accident, and he had terrible, intrusive memories, flashbacks to the event, and I interviewed a war veteran and so on who had similar experiences. The question is there anything special about how memory works in trauma? The one thing we know about how emotion relates to memory is that emotions heighten memory. We have better memory for stuff that's emotionally powerful, and that's a very well-established finding. The question is, are there separate processes at work when we remember a tremendously powerful emotional event? My reading of the scientific evidence is that there aren't any separate special mechanisms. You can account for the way that memory works in trauma through using what we know about ordinary memory, the fact that memory is heightened by emotion, the fact that memories are reconstructions, and so on. And so a lot of this debate comes from really what Freud argued, or is taken to have argued, about how we repress bad memories. There are these sort of unconscious forces pushing memories out of our minds. There's no scientific evidence, to my reading of it, that this is the case. It is possible to stop thinking about traumatic memories. It is possible to push them out of your mind consciously, but there doesn't seem to be strong evidence that it's possible to do that unconsciously, that there are these unconscious forces repressing. We can suppress, but we don't seem to repress.
You also bring up at the very end of your book that there's the possibility, there's beginning to be conversation about the possibility of manipulating traumatic memories by locating where they are in the brain and seeing if you can take them out. I mean, what's the conversation there and the ethics of that?
Well, there's some amazing research being done with mice in particular, where they're using some, unusual techniques for getting for switching genes on and off, and then using light pulses to kind of trigger particular neurons or clusters of neurons. And there's been some success with kind of switching certain memories for emotional events on and off in mice. But the thing is, you're talking about much smaller brains. You're talking about much simpler neural systems and very isolated, focused clusters of neurons, which you can manipulate in what would be a very, very invasive method. None of us want to have, the genes in our neurons change so that light can switch them on and off. You know, it wouldn't be an acceptable, as you say, it wouldn't be an ethical solution. The other thing with human memories for these traumatic events is that, as I've said, it's a machine with many moving parts. There are lots of things happening. You know, the whole of your brain almost is in operation when you recall an autobiographical memory. So how would you pin it down? How could you pin down a particular traumatic memory to any particular part of the brain so you could zap it or, you know, give a pill or whatever? It might be possible for certain kind of unconscious reactions to a particular, a loud bang, for example. If you have a war veteran who shows anxiety when he hears a loud bang, it might be possible to target those very specific memories. But wiping out a memory wholesale, where would you start? You know, it's scattered. The reconstruction is formed from stuff that's scattered all around the brain. How would you possibly pin that down? There are certain things that are being done. It seems that by making use of the fact of reconsolidation, when you ask people to recall a traumatic memory and then ask them to take a drug that calms them down, like a beta blocker, that seems to have some effect in reducing the emotional salience
of
the memory.
As they're reconstructing
it. It makes it less emotional.
Oh, that's so interesting.
You mentioned the ethics of it. If I said to you, Anna, if you had a bad memory, a memory that caused you pain to think about, we all have them, okay? If I said to you, look, I've got this pill, and if you take this pill, that bad memory will go away. What would you say? Would you take the pill or not?
No.
You wouldn't take the pill. Well, about 80% of people, if you ask them this question, they would say they would not take the pill. They'd rather have the bad memory. And I guess if you ask them further, they'd say something like, I know it's a bad memory, it hurts, but it's part of who I am. That percentage changes slightly. If you gave people a scenario where, you know, imagine you've been in the military and you've seen a terrible, you know, explosion in which one of your friends has been killed, and you have a terrible traumatic memory of that event, would you take the pill? And here about 50% of people say they would take the pill. So many more people are willing to take the pill in that context. So I personally wouldn't take the pill, you wouldn't take the pill, but then I don't have memories like the memories of the people that I talked to for this book, people who'd seen their own friends killed in war, people who'd seen somebody die in a road traffic accident. You know, it might be a different matter if I had that very, very strong traumatic memory.
I want to bring in Caroline from Scotch Plains, New Jersey, who has an interesting take on good memories and bad memories. Caroline, you consider yourself having a bad memory?
Yeah, I feel like I don't have much in the way of like fact recall, and the reason that I'm aware of it is, well, my husband and I, we were brought up very different ways. I lived in the same town, the same house my entire life. My husband moved practically every year. He was always in a different place, and if you ask my husband, he can recall every address he ever lived at, every phone number he ever had, every teacher's name he ever had, where he was when things happened. He remembers classmates that he had from every single grade. Whereas I was in school with the same people my entire life, and I can barely bring their faces to my memory, versus let alone their names. And I'm just wondering how much of that is, you know, me being in one place and sort of all the years blending together, whereas he has, with so much change, he has, you know, things to tie his memories to. And how much of that is just our brains and our brain chemistry? And, you know, why are we so different in that way?
Well, I think it could be to do with the fact that the different contexts. It may be that he's had a more interesting life story, if I may put it that way, where he's lived in different places and he's got more context to pin certain memories onto, as you say, more different contexts. But I think also we're just bound to differ in this respect. You know, my wife can remember extraordinarily detailed, you know, information about who was wearing what on a particular day that we went to do something. And I don't know, that stuff completely passes me by. What I would say, when I say to people I've written a book about memory, they often say to me, oh, so are you going to help me remember stuff better? And I'm like, well, I'm about the stories that you tell about your own past, your memories for your own life. That's what this book is about. I'm not here to tell you how to remember, you know, 20 packs of playing cards or pie to a million places. That kind of remembering isn't of interest to me. It's a different kind of memory to the one that I'm talking about. We're talking about, you know, memory for facts and so on. Whereas I'm interested in the memory that we have for the stories of our own lives.
So I
would say, why do we need to recall a lot of stuff? What use is it? I'd rather remember the things that happened to me in a richer way so that I can re-experience them in a more vivid manner.
Is there just one tip that you can leave us with, that if we're in a moment that is just one you want to capture and grab onto and not forget, is there something I can do so my brain will record it in a maybe a little bit better than it would otherwise?
Well, obviously you can pay attention. You can encode the information more richly if you can, just by paying attention to what's going on around you. But you can also elaborate. You can talk to people about it. If you've shared that moment with somebody, you can talk about it. That will create a more elaborate representation of the event. But also writing. I'm a big fan of writing a diary. I write down stuff that happened to me, and it makes a huge difference to what I recall and what I don't recall going, you know, lasting over 20 years or so. I look back at these old diaries, and I think, you know, the past comes back to me in a way that it just wouldn't otherwise.
All right, Charles Fernyhough, he's the author of the new book, Pieces of Light, How the New Science of Memory Illuminates the Stories We Tell About Our Own Past. Thank you so much for joining us on WNYC.
Thank you, Anna.